Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lamb and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside Simon and I today is personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And we have a special guest, because today we explore what barbed wire, disposable razors, concrete and TV dinners all have in common. Well, according to our undercover economist, they are some of the 50 things that made the modern economy. We're talking to Tim Harford.
I want you to imagine catastrophe. The end of civilization. This complex, intricate modern world of ours is finished. Don't worry about why. Maybe it was swine flu or nuclear war, killer robots or the zombie apocalypse. And now imagine that you, lucky you, are one of the few survivors. You have no phone. Who would you phone anyway? No internet, no electricity, no fuel. 4 decades ago, the science historian James Burke posed that scenario in his TV series, Connections. And he asked a simple question. Surrounded by the wreckage of modernity, without access to the lifeblood of modern technology, where do you start again? What do you need to keep yourself and the embers of civilization alive?
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, making saving that little bit more exciting.
A good question. What do you need to keep the embers of civilization alive? Also, are we on the verge of the fourth industrial revolution? How does technology shape us? And why perhaps we should be more afraid of Jennifer than Rachel? Not Rickard-Strauss, I should point out. She's a pussycat. A very warm welcome, Tim, Simon and Rachel. So, Tim, 50 things that made the modern economy. I found it as much a history of humanity. Some of the stories are tragic, some are banal, but all profoundly changed our lives. How interesting did you find this project?
It was tremendous fun to work on, to be honest. To step away from the everyday stuff and to be able to go back in time 7,000 years, to be able to look at the far future and to explore the stories of these different inventions, that was really... It was great fun. I'm just interested in how we communicate ideas about economics and finance, and it's often very abstract, a lot of numbers, quite dry, theoretical. So to say, oh, here's a thing, there's this bunch of people who were working on it, or this single inventor who created this thing, and here are all the unintended consequences. Been terrific fun to work on.
Where on earth do you start? How do you manage to compile a list of 50?
Well, the fun thing is that it's not the list of the 50 most important things. It's just 50 things that I thought were interesting, 50 great stories. So I'm on the lookout for stories. So I sat down with friends, I sat down with science historians and with technology specialists and just everyone I met. I would buttonhole them for ideas and you have to write them all down. And then you start thinking, OK, what's missing? Are there any industries that are missing? Any parts of the world? Any time periods? Because it was a World Service podcast, BBC World Service podcast. So you want a good geographical spread. But yeah, mostly just sniffing around for really, really good stories. That was the brief.
Why does it matter?
Well, the world around us is a pretty bewildering place, and it's often hard to figure out where we fit in, how things work, who's pulling the strings. Is anyone pulling the strings? Maybe no one's in charge. Who knows? It often seems that way. So what I was trying to do was to help people understand the world around them, particularly the economic world around them, although our society is so woven in with finance and economics that it's sometimes hard to tell the difference. And so to go back and to say this was the first time, for example, that electricity revolutionized manufacturing, or this was the first time that people figured out you could use this double entry method of keeping books, and how accountancy shaped the world. Being able to point to specific moments in history where something was invented and then to start tracing how it affects us today. And that was what it was all about.
Well, I liked as well some of the really personal stories around it. Although I have to say, I listened to the first two podcasts and there's some real tragedy. I mean, real tragedy.
I think we began with two tragic Germans. Actually, I wasn't sure why we went for like the double whammy of tragic Germans. It was Rudolf Diesel, wasn't it? And then it was Fritz Haber. And Diesel, no prizes for guessing what Diesel invented. But he probably killed himself because there was no money in the diesel engine. This amazing invention wasn't really perfected until after his death. And then Fritz Haber, I mean, the story of Fritz Haber and his very, very talented wife, Clara Immerwahr, talented chemist, but very frustrated because it's the late 19th century, early 20th century. Women aren't getting along in German science, but they're not really being given opportunities anywhere. And so there's this interplay between Fritz Haber, who develops artificial fertilizer, Brot aus Luft, the way of taking bread out of the air, as the Germans said. And he develops this amazing technology, and then he weaponizes chlorine gas, and his wife, disgusted with him, kills herself with his service revolver. So, yeah, we maybe maxed out on tragic Germans. There are some happier stories in the
world. There are, but I did think at the time I've got 48 more of these to go.
Well, there are kind of inventors who just invented really cool stuff and lived happily ever after, rich and successful and content. There's all that as well.
Yeah. Well, I'll get Rachel and Simon's and I's pick shortly, but what was yours? Can you pick one?
I can pick one, actually. I do. Okay. I have a soft spot for paper. It's partly that paper gets no great love, right? Nobody was thinking, oh, paper, very, very important invention. But it's everywhere. We use it to decorate our walls. We use it to wipe all kinds of things. We use it to build corrugated cardboard boxes out of. And of course, we use it as a surface for printing. And when I was working on the book, everybody said, oh, you must include the Gutenberg press, the movable type printing press. This gave us the Reformation and the textbook and the newspaper. And it put Europe, for the first time, Europe becomes at the forefront of world civilization. And the Gutenberg press changed everything. But of course, it's an economics series. And the economics of printing don't work without a cheap writing surface. I mean, you can print on other things, but you'll never make any money unless you've got a cheap writing surface. And the cheap writing surface, invented 2,000 years ago in China, is paper. So the reason I love paper is because it's so important, it's so ubiquitous, and it gets no attention. So that's why I liked it.
Great stat that it took something like 250 sheep to produce a Bible in the old way.
If you want a sort of successful print run of Bibles, you might have sort of 2,000-4,000 copies. So then you're talking maybe a million sheep, or certainly a few hundred thousand sheep. And so, nothing wrong with it technologically. A lot of the early Gutenberg Bibles were printed on parchment. They were printed on sheepskin. But you're not going to make any money that way. You need a cheaper way to make a writing surface, and that's what paper was.
And good news for the sheep as well. So we're going to take Simon's pick first. Simon, not paper. Which of the 50, and actually we should say 51, because you did open the last one up to the public, which we'll get onto shortly. But Simon, your pick.
Well, so what I thought was really interesting about the book was the fact that it walks you through all of these things that you don't pay much attention to in everyday life. And I think a lot of us spend our time just wandering around blindly not paying any attention to anything in the world. And that some of the stuff that actually makes quite a big difference is really in itself quite dull. So I like the shipping container. Basically, because of that element of, and what I thought it brought out was the whole thing about global trade, which obviously is a big thing at the moment for the UK, and how much easier it made it compared to how much harder it was before that. And it seems like such a logical thing to do, but until that sort of shipping container standardised existed, you said people were just trying to stuff things into corners or pile things on pallets and everything like that. And then also how there was a tension between the shipping and the trucking world, and it had to try and work for both. But then there was another one that I liked as well that followed on from that, which was the cold chain and getting refrigerated goods around the world so that you could, so the Argentinians could export their beef, or they could export bananas from Guatemala and things like that. And I don't think we really think about that stuff.
The cold chain also contains the line "crazier than a dozen opium smoking frogs," which is a good line.
Yeah, I mean, that might have been why I liked it. But it is that kind of bit where you like when you go and buy something from the shop. I mean, when you put something into your fridge, you don't think about, oh, well, hang on, this started on the other side of the planet. When people go out and buy their Christmas presents, they're not going to think, why does it make economic sense for someone to make something in China and then flog it to me for almost nothing? And I think those two things put those in perspective.
So. Yeah, and there's a lot going on behind the scenes of the world economy that we don't see, that we don't think of. You know, we see certain kinds of jobs either in our day-to-day lives or portrayed on the television, in film. There are certain things that get a lot of attention, and then there's an awful lot just going on under the surface. Like the waste system is another thing. Like the people who recycle our waste, we pay no attention whatsoever to this. So, I liked The Shipping Container. There is a great book about The Shipping Container by Mark Levinson, and he says, this invention has got all the romance of a tin can. This is the guy who wrote a book about it. But it completely changed the world. More, I think, arguably more than trade agreements like NAFTA and the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade and the European Single Market. Arguably, this very simple technology made even more of a difference. And one of the things that I found striking about it was the ballsiness and imagination of one guy, Malcolm McLean, who didn't invent it, but he pushed the system. He figured out how to make the system work, and then he handled all the politics and all the kind of relations with all sorts of weird financial and legal shenanigans he had to get up to make it work, handle the unions, handle the port authorities. And one of his big coups was supplying logistical services to the US military in Vietnam, which not only is that a nice big contract for him, but he's then got empty shipping containers and empty ships on the western coast of the Pacific. And he just cruises up to Yokohama, the harbour of Tokyo, picks up goods from Japan and ships them back to California. And that really kickstarts this trans-Pacific trade that's such a cornerstone of the modern economy.
And there was, I think, three things in that I quite liked. Was firstly the bit where you made the point that in sort of economic modelling, the cost of shipping is basically considered to be zero because it's so cheap, which made me quite interested to think that you can get something from one side of the world to the other and you basically write it out of your model because it's so cheap. It's not free, but it's close
to being free. And yeah.
And then there was the fact that the longshoremen, the people who used to unload the ships, effectively really didn't like this idea because it made their life much easier. And I love examples like that where people don't like an idea because it makes their life much easier because they can see the threat that it brings to them, essentially to their jobs and things like that, so understandably. But also the other one was the guy, Malcolm McLean, that you mentioned. Did he then go bust afterwards and then suddenly bounce back with another business or something?
Yeah, he went bust. It was a bit later, but he went bust in the 80s because he had invested. It was a real visionary and willing to take risks, and he invested heavily in these super efficient ships in the early 1980s. Just had the oil crisis, suddenly diesel for these ships, very, very expensive. He sinks a load of money into these top of the range, super efficient cargo ships, and then the oil price collapses in 1986, I think. And suddenly there's no way for him to make his investment back because fuel's cheap again. And so that's what drove him out of business. But yeah, he came back in his 80s. He launched another shipping company. So yeah, it's indefatigable.
Just a word you mentioned there about the book that you used. How did you pick your sources? Because you used different sources.
Yeah, I mean, a huge number of different sources. And very often with a really interesting invention, somebody's written the book or several people have written the book. So yeah, I mean, I'm not a historian of technology. Mm. So you're constantly on the lookout for good sources. And sometimes there are classic economics papers that have looked at the impact of a particular invention that I'm aware of. Other times you're just Googling around until you get a solid source. One, for example, is Claudia Goldin, who is a great American economist, used to be president of the American Economic Association fairly recently. And she, with a couple of other economists, has this great study of what impact the contraceptive pill had on professional women's careers and professional women's education in the United States. doing this trick that a lot of economists do, which is to say, well, things happened in different US states at different moments, and so you're able to use that as a statistical tool to figure out what was going on. But yeah, sometimes you just, there must be something interesting about the U-bend. Let's start with a Wikipedia page and see where we go. And Wikipedia is an amazing starting point for, you know, of course, there have been hundreds of books written about it. And away you go and you chase them up and get them out of the library. I live in Oxford, so the great thing is I have access to Oxford's library system. So lucky, lucky me.
I was going to say, you could get lost in doing all of this. The discipline you must have taken, how long did this take?
Well, it was a bit of a hurry, because once it would have been May 2016, I guess, the BBC started to say, yeah, we're interested, let's talk. I went to my publishers and said, we could do a book, couldn't we? And they said, great, yeah, but we really want to publish the book kind of while the series is on air. And that means you kind of have to finish the book before the series has really started. Yeah. So, really, the bulk of the book was written in the second half of 2016. And, it was fun, but... I'm surrounded by students in the Bodleian Library going, you guys don't realise how lucky you are. There's so many interesting facts here and you all look so bored. And yeah, I was having fun anyway.
And it helps having a deadline, eh?
It always does.
Rachel, OK, so we've got shipping containers, we've got paper. Rachel, for you?
For me, the battery. For so many reasons. Firstly...
It's not the rectum story, is it?
I wasn't going to talk specifically about the rectum story, but we can do that too.
Okay. Just checking.
It was because I liked imagining a world without them, first of all. That really made me laugh. I liked imagining the world without lots of these lifts. That was fun. But imagine no batteries. I mean, I think you mentioned the absence of batteries with remote controls. But think what a tangle we'd be in if everything was still connected up. Yeah. And just what it's done for mobility. But also I liked it because its story's not ended. I think we're just beginning with the battery, and that's quite exciting.
I think you're right.
Your list is not 50 by order of importance, but were it, I think the battery will be shuffled up in the next few years. So just thinking about my old 3310 Nokia and how that used to last for about, you'd get about 5 days' worth out of them, wouldn't you, without having to charge them?
Because the phone never did anything, right? Well, no serious screen, no serious computing power, and you're not constantly checking and you're kind of noodling around on Twitter on it. Not that you would ever have such bad habits. But
we've got a long way to go in that respect. But then also... I just think, as you talk about as well, to be able to store renewable energy will, I hope, transform everything. Yeah. I mean, once you can have solar panels on your roof and maybe your own little turbine or one shared with your community, and you can store that and use it at other times, then goodbye fossil fuels.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the battery does have these two quite separate roles. There's portability, and yeah, so much of the technology we now take for granted, like laptops and smartphones, just impossible without the battery. I mean, obviously you could, before the battery, you could have a clockwork watch, but of course you think about when the last time you actually changed your watch battery and how small the watch battery is, you realize the power it takes to run a watch is tiny, the amount of energy you need to store is tiny, so you can run it on clockwork. You're not really going to be able to run a smartphone on clockwork. So all of that portable stuff, you can forget it. So there's that. But then, as you say, this new role for batteries that just is just emerging as a large-scale, non-mobile storage system for interruptible supplies like wind, solar, incredibly important if we can get the cost down low enough. And there's been a lot of progress there. And one of the interesting things is that this then potentially intersects with electric cars. Because one of the things we think about electric cars, you need to have a really good battery in an electric car. But what people, I think, often don't think of is, they think about the charging of electric cars, but they don't think that electric cars are a huge resource. That is millions and millions of very large batteries just kind of drifting around. And so you could use those to smooth out grid fluctuations, potentially. If we can get the batteries cheap enough and ubiquitous enough, and we can get the market working well enough, because it's a market design problem, everyone will plug their electric car in front of their house, and the car will be talking to the house, and the house will be talking to the smart grid, and everybody will be saying, well, what is electricity demand right now? What is electricity supply right now? Is the sun shining? Is the wind blowing? Are people putting their kettles on? And the cars will potentially be feeding energy to the houses and then back again and forward and back and forward and back to take advantage of fluctuations in price. And I mean, it's a completely different way of thinking about the way the energy grid might work. And it all depends on these batteries working.
I'm going to bring the tone down a little bit and say the one that I quite liked him was TV dinners. Now, the reason why is it because it completely made me think about liberation of women. You mentioned the contraceptive pill there, but I remember, and you said that it changed in the 1960s, but I remember even when my mum spent hours to do all the chores, cook the meals, and she was a full-time doctor as well, and it wasn't in the 60s, I won't give my age away. And I love the way you talk about how people suggested to you that the washing machine should have perhaps been picked instead as something to liberate women. But in fact, the reality was, well, we just didn't wash as many clothes before. So we'd rather stink, but we weren't willing to starve.
Yeah. And this is a wonderful story that people tell about the washing machine, that I was all geared up and ready to tell the same story. Like the washing machine is this huge force for women's empowerment. And of course, the tumble dryer and the fridge and these various other domestic appliances. But the washing machine stands for all of them. That women were basically just, they were chained to these domestic tasks. Women were the ones expected to do them. The men didn't do them. And so that meant that women couldn't go out to work. So they were working unpaid in the home instead of getting economic and financial independence by working outside the home. And the washing machine changes all of that. That's the story. Then I started looking at the data and I read a great book by Professor Alison Wolfe called The Double X Factor. And she was pointing me to other resources. And it turns out when you look at time use diaries, this is an underappreciated source of economic data, but there are these time use diaries that we've got of how people spent their hours going way back at least to the 60s. And we've got patchier data back probably to the 20s. The washing machine didn't change the amount of time that people spent, usually women, doing laundry. Because, as you say, people would just skimp on the laundry and they'd just be a bit...
Detachable collars
of
thing.
Yeah, well, my mother-in-law told me that when she was at school, when she was a schoolgirl, this would have been in the 40s, I guess, they changed their uniform once a term. And they'd change the collars, they'd change the cuffs, and they'd have... I mean, they're primary school, so hopefully not too stinky, but still. And they would have pads in their armpits. And the pads would kind of absorb the armpit stinks and sweats, and you'd wash the pads, but you wouldn't wash the blouses. Because why would you wash anything? Because it's so difficult. So when the washing machine comes along, everyone's like, oh, great, we can wash stuff more, and it doesn't save any time. However, the TV dinner, and not just the TV dinner, but things like pre-chopped salads, pre-plucked chicken, all the different food preparated, the microwave, the whole lot, a huge sort of flotilla of food industrialization technologies, they change everything because people eat as many meals as they ever did. But suddenly it's much, much quicker to prepare these meals or to order takeout or go out and eat somewhere fairly affordable. And that frees up a huge amount of time for women. So it's the same story as the washing machine. It's a bit less romantic because, of course, not all this food is very good for us. But it has the merit that this particular story is true.
Well, that's it. It's not just about the fact that it freed women from chores. It impacted on working lives. Women could go out to work more. It freed our waistlines, as you put it. It's the way that we eat, the impact on how we're eating, how we're spending our money going out and the calories that we're consuming. It's all encompassed in this.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of the research on why obesity has increased. There is some good news, actually. Obesity may not be increasing anymore, but it certainly has increased dramatically over the last 30, 40 years. A lot of that research, initially, your instinct is, oh, that is because the food's got cheaper, right? Cheaper food, people eat more food. It's not so much that. It's got cheaper in terms of time. So it's easier and easier to snack. And the quintessential example is basically bags of crisps. So it used to be really quite a faff to eat finely sliced, fried, salted potatoes. Delicious, but, you know, what a treat because it was so difficult to prepare. And now they're just, you know, vacuum packed in a foil bag and you just grab them as you pass a railway station or, you know, in a supermarket. And because the snack food has become so easy to get hold of and so cheap in terms of time, that's what seems to have changed things. We don't consume any more calories in our main meals. We just have all these extra little opportunities to graze.
You did open up the 51st, and we'll talk about this one, because my second option was credit cards, which actually was what the public voted for. Why did you decide to do that? Was because you hadn't finished the book in time and you needed to make sure.
Well, actually, I wish the book was all done by then. We've got great ideas. So yeah, the BBC said, "Oh, hang on, why don't we open it all up and crowdsource it and get people to send in their ideas?" So we got literally hundreds of ideas sent in. One that I wished I'd put on the short. Well, no, I'm glad I didn't put it on the shortlist. But one idea that someone sent in is pornography. And the idea being, there is this story that people tell, and I don't know if it's true. I'd love to find out. There's a story people tell that pornography has shaped one technology after another, from basically early photography and then instant photography and video cameras and a VHS. Like, why would you pay thousands and thousands of pounds to have an early VHS recorder in your home when you could just go to the movies? Well, it turns out there's a certain kind of film that people might want to watch in private. And then it drives video on the internet. It drives credit card processing on the internet. That's the story. And I thought, okay, if it was one of my 50, I would gladly have done that. But I'm not going to put it on a shortlist of six and ask people to vote, because then the winner will be porn. And then I will have to explain to the BBC that the most important invention in the history of the world economy is porn. So I didn't put it on the list, but I would have gladly put it on a list of 50. In the end, the shortlist was my choice. I picked six, and it was credit cards, the digital spreadsheet, the pencil, irrigation, GPS, and glass. Which glass is another underrated thing, because it's everywhere. It's the internet's made of glass, right? Fiberglass. Mm. And glasses for spectacles, glasses for windows, glasses for microscopes and telescopes that have revolutionised the way we see the world. So lots of great ideas there. And I thought GPS or glass would win, but people voted for credit cards, which is also good. And so we did a final episode on credit cards. And the thing that fascinates me about the credit card is there's so much psychology in it. I mean, it's technologically interesting and innovative, but a lot of this is about what happens to people when you give them an opportunity to basically spend as much money as they want, anywhere they want. You know, can we be trusted with this potentially financial weapon of mass destruction?
Well, you were in the studio with three personal finance journalists. Simon, what did you make of credit cards coming in at number 51?
I think the thing that's interesting about the credit card is basically quite how generous a credit card is, and the credit card system is, in a lot of ways. So, for example, you've got the thing where it'll protect you on purchases that cost more than £100, so this Section 75 thing. You've got the fact that the credit card company is effectively lending you money with no guarantee that you're going to pay it back, because it's an unsecured debt, you can walk away from it. You've got the phenomenon we've seen over the last 5 years, certainly in this country, with credit cards, of interest-free balance transfers and purchase periods. Someone will basically lend you money to buy something interest-free for 3 years, 3.5 years, you know, in some instances. Why are they doing this? Well, they're not doing all this stuff out of the generosity of their heart. It's not because credit card companies like you and they just want to help you out. It's because credit cards are so lucrative for credit card companies and banks that they can basically afford to just throw free stuff at you, like literally just chuck it at the wall. And some of it does stick. There are people out there who do very well indeed out of credit cards, because so many people do so badly out of them. And that's what I think is really interesting about credit cards.
And this goes back to the very early days of credit cards. They did this thing called the Fresno drop, which was Bank of America just trying to... They realised this doesn't work unless we get a lot of credit cards out there, because merchants won't accept this. They won't carry the terminals. They won't carry the technology. They won't train their staff unless lots of people are using credit cards. So we need a lot of credit cards out there. And so they just mailed people with what in today's money it would be a $5,000 credit limit. Just anybody with a Bank of America current account got one of these things. And there was mass fraud. People would just steal them from other people's mailboxes. And there were all kinds of problems. But they just swallowed it, because they said, this is going to be a money spinner in the long run. And it was.
I think you cited a study where people were asked about credit card availability and whether they thought it was appropriate. And people seemed to think that other people couldn't be trusted with credit cards, but didn't really recognise that they were saying that they could, and that there was some kind of discrepancy there. But it that seems to get to the heart of the extraordinary psychology behind them, how normalised they've become. I mean, people like to call them debt cards and things like that, because even the word credit sounds so much more palatable and friendly than what it actually is. They're so ubiquitous, they're so normalised. And I think it's another story, actually, that we're going to watch play out. I mean, the FCA had stats last year that 4 million credit cards can never be repaid. At the rate that they're currently being paid, you may as well just write them off.
Yeah, it's interesting, and that some credit card companies are not even that worried if the card balance is never repaid, as long as you just keep it ticking over at a, I think they call it sweating. You're sweating the credit card. You know, if the interest rate's 30% and somebody is basically at least making their interest rate payments, even if they never, ever, ever manage to repay the principal, it's potentially a money spinner for the credit card. And the word credit is something I tapped into in the piece that I did. The word credit, of course, originally refers to trust, people being trusted. And what I traced was the history of who gets trusted to do what in terms of finance and consumer finance. And initially, of course, it's your local shopkeeper who knows you, who knows your mum, who can complain about you to your mum in church on Sunday if you don't, you know, pay the bill at the local grocery store. And then it switches to an urban environment, and then suddenly you need a card to identify who you are. So they know you're good for the money because you're an upstanding citizen, but nevertheless, the shop assistant might not recognise you. So you show your card to identify yourself. And then the next step that comes with Diners Club and then Visa and American Express and so on, the next step is a card that allows you to be trusted not just by anybody at a particular store, but by any store. And I think there's this gradual process, and the final step of the process is, because as Simon says, it's kind of this rolling balance of you can spend the money on anything. And they don't just lend you the money so you can buy a car or you can buy a sofa. It's like whatever. You spend it on anything you like, and you repay whenever you like. As long as you meet the minimum payments and you pay the interest, you repay whenever you like. And this is just, it's in this enormous amount of freedom. Like, you can spend it anywhere and no one's going to ask you what you spent it on or when you're ever going to pay the money back. And that's extraordinary.
I wonder if there's another step as well, that by having one of these cards at one point that had a certain amount of status, because it showed that you are trusted and your association with whichever brand it is. But because they became so ubiquitous, then we've ended up with black cards and platinum cards and super duper cards that only very special people can get. Yeah. And you put one of those down to pay the bill at the end of an evening and it says something about you.
Yeah, well, exactly what it says is not clear, but yes. I mean, actually, I wanted to write about this, but there just wasn't enough time in the piece. But there was definitely a step change, I think, in the late 70s, early 80s, where the credit card companies previously, they'd said, oh, we want people with plenty of money. And so the credit card had status. And then they said, actually, people with money don't really need credit cards. What we need is people who don't, or at least temporarily don't have money. So they started targeting students, and they started targeting recently divorced women. So these are people who don't have money, but might well in the future have money. And that's the perfect market for the credit card. So suddenly the status goes out of the window, but the credit card companies realise, hang on, they're missing a trick.
You've said that now is a perplexing time to think about how technology shapes us. But I wonder how much we shape the trajectory of these innovations, like credit cards. You're talking about psychology. I know you've spoken a lot about behavioural economics and the integration of psychology and economics. But I'm wondering here, how we shape the trajectory of these innovations.
Yeah. I mean, in the end, if people cannot be persuaded to take up a particular technology, to use a particular technology, then it's not going to catch on. And I think one of the interesting things we're starting to realise more and more focus on design thinking, been made very fashionable by Steve Jobs and Apple, and they realised, oh, hang on, great design helps. But we're thinking more and more about what it is about a technology that makes it easy to use, that makes it friendly, that makes it cool. And previously there was this idea that, well, if it works and if it's effective, then people will put in the work. But more and more now, there's this emphasis on ease of use. And you see it in the physical technology we have around us, like the smartphones, but you also see it in financial technologies. So the most obvious example is payday loans and just the emphasis on making it incredibly easy, incredibly convenient. And you have the Church of England coming in and saying, well, we're going to support credit unions so that people can get access to money much, much cheaper than the payday companies. But it's not about whether it's cheap, it's about whether it's easy. And that's what the credit card companies do, and even more the payday loan companies do.
You speak about how many innovations follow the toilet paper principle over being truly revolutionary. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so the toilet paper principle is once an invention gets so cheap you can wipe all kinds of things with it, then that is cheap enough to change the world. What I was emphasising, this was in an article for the Financial Times magazine, was that we tend to make certain mistakes when we're thinking about technologies. I mean, I learned about this through reflecting on the experience of writing the book. We focus on incredibly clever, sophisticated stuff, the artificial intelligence, nuclear fusion, the flying cars, all of this stuff. That's what...
You talk about Blade Runner.
Yeah,
in this article, right?
Rachel the organic robot in Blade Runner. What we tend to miss is that that sort of technology can be important, but more often than not, it's just stuff that becomes very cheap. And because it's very cheap, it becomes ubiquitous. And then it's cheap enough to change the world. So we've talked about paper. We've talked about the shipping container. Another example is barbed wire, which completely reshaped the American West, purely because it was an inexpensive fencing material at a time when the settlers desperately wanted to fence off land and keep out the cowboys and keep out the Native Americans and lay claim to land. Barbed wire was cheap enough. And in fact, it was marketed as being lighter than air, stronger than whiskey, and cheaper than dust. And so we should focus on stuff that has become cheap, because when stuff becomes very, very cheap, like toilet paper, that's when the world starts to change.
I'm wondering if there's things around us at the moment that perhaps wouldn't make the book now, but would in 10, 20, 30 years' time, because we've just not seen the full economic benefits of some of those innovations that are around us. We have to kind of work out how to reshape our economy, as you talk about, to take advantage of them. And you mentioned there electricity triumphed only when factories themselves were configured.
Yeah, we reshape our societies to accommodate technology. We think of technology as something that we shape, we control, and it fits into the way we like to do things. But in fact, most technologies, they change us. They change our organizations, they change our personal behavior, they change our societies. And we adjust to fit the technology and not the other way around. That's how it often goes. What's around us that is going to change the world in the future? I'm, of course, an economist, so vastly unsuited to making any kind of forecasts. The most obvious thing is sensors. Sensors of all kinds are getting very, very cheap. And so increasingly, you know, our phones, maybe even our clothes, certainly our cars, our buildings are going to be measuring temperature, pressure, location, taking digital snapshots, learning in all kinds of ways. The latest incarnation of that is very cheap satellites with high quality cameras, more and more and more of them now taking photos of chunks of the Earth every single day. You get a new satellite photograph every single day, and people starting to use this to, for example, say, well, there's a photograph of an oil tanker. Is it full of oil or is it empty? We can judge that by the length of the shadow. I mean, just things that we wouldn't have imagined in the past. So, yeah, with plenty of surprises ahead.
I guess the only concern there is the fact that as stuff becomes cheap, it also has a habit of becoming increasingly widespread, but also increasingly shonky and not working. It might work quite well when it's brand new, but then about 2 or 3 years down the line. And I have this horrible vision of a world of sensors where the doors won't open without a sensor, this won't work without a sensor, that won't work without a sensor, and about sort of 4 or 5 years after the widespread adoption, everything just stops working properly. Yeah, and anybody who's ever had to deal with electronics obviously recognises that scenario. And I think we're probably going to see it in a lot of cars, for example, which now have a huge amount of sensors in them to deal with various things. And that's the bit that scares everyone about dealing with modern cars is the sort of the electrics and stuff. But I think actually is this wave of stuff that's going on now, all the smart stuff going into them, that might in sort of 5 or 6 years be a bit of a problem.
It sounds all too plausible. We'll see. You may well be right.
You do make an interesting point about the world of work and robots taking over our jobs, making us all redundant. Actually, we should be focusing on the concept of tasks.
Yes. So this is an important idea from the American economist David Auter, who says, look, we think about jobs. Jobs are a very human-centered concept. Like, people have jobs. But in terms of the economics of it, we should be thinking about tasks. And most jobs are like, they're collections of tasks. They're bundles of different tasks. So you think about the things that you do. If you've got a job, think for a moment about your job. Think about all the different things you do as part of that job. What happens when technology changes is the technology will automate away, not a job, it'll automate away a task. And that you can see this again and again. One of my favorite examples is the digital spreadsheet. So spreadsheets used to be sheets. They used to be physical pieces of paper, and you would write on these physical pieces of paper with pen and pencil and an eraser, and you'd have a calculator, and accounting clerks would physically have to manually recalculate and rub out and correct all of the numbers on a spreadsheet, which made accounting incredibly labor intensive. And there's no way you could just say, I wonder what that would look with like a 6% discount rate instead of a 4% discount rate. I mean, just forget it. It's far too difficult. 1979, the first digital spreadsheet is introduced, and all those accounting clerks are out of work almost overnight, not quite overnight, but certainly within a decade. It's all gone. All replaced by digital spreadsheets. But accountancy hasn't gone. We still have accountants, and those people largely moved on to do different jobs because that particular task disappeared, but their jobs didn't disappear. And I think when you're trying to figure out what sort of jobs are most vulnerable to automation, how will robots and artificial intelligence reshape the workplace, you've got to focus on it one task at a time. They will come not for the jobs, but for the tasks.
So do you think we're on the verge of a fourth industrial revolution?
I'm genuinely torn. So there's a lot of hype about this. The most amazing recent example is AlphaZero. I lose track of the name of this machine now because they keep changing it. But it's come from DeepMind, which is owned by Google. And the founder of DeepMind is Demis Hassabis. I interviewed him for the Financial Times about 3 years ago, and he was talking about this stuff he was going to do. And I was like, oh, that's all very interesting. You know? And now he's doing it, and it's really happening. And AlphaZero, the paper was just a research paper was just published. It's just beaten the world's best chess program, having taught itself to play chess in 4 hours from a standing start. In 4 hours, and I forget the exact number, but the Stockfish is the world's best chess engine. It was running, I think, 100 times faster than AlphaZero. But AlphaZero also beat the world's greatest Go program, which is a recent predecessor, 100-0, again, having taught itself in 4 hours. So you think this is what people talk about when they're talking about exponential growth. That's the thing that makes you think something big is about to happen. But then you go, okay, where are all the job losses? Unemployment is at record lows. The employment rate in the UK economy is at record highs. Meanwhile, productivity is low. So people working really, really, really hard, but not producing very much. That sounds like the opposite of a fourth industrial revolution. So I am genuinely confused. I think the most likely resolution of the puzzle is the same thing that I discussed with the spread of the electric motor in American manufacturing 125 years ago, which is you have the technological breakthrough and then you just have to wait. And you might have to wait a quarter of a century. Because everything else has to change to adapt to the new technology. So, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen, but I suspect it's going to happen slightly slower than we think, and then it's going to be very dramatic when it does.
I interviewed Max Tegmark recently, who wrote a book, Life 3.0, who said that this machine that's beaten the best chess player and also Go has been doing something which we sort of see as one of the last hiding places of humanity, which is creativity. I mean, we sort of allow ourselves to think that machines and robots might be able to do this, they might be able to do that, but at least we've got creativity.
Yeah.
But what did you call it? Alpha?
It was AlphaGo, and then it was AlphaGo Zero, and the latest one I think is called Alpha Zero. I may be wrong.
So Alpha Zero played a move in Go that no one had thought to play before. There's received wisdom about how you play the game to play most efficiently. It did something that no one had ever thought of, which is creativity.
Yeah, and the original AlphaGo was given Grandmaster Games to learn from, but the new incarnation was just like, here are the rules, figure it out. And so it's completely operating from scratch. It is remarkable. And they're now getting it to play StarCraft 2, which is interesting because StarCraft 2 has more kind of, there's economics, there's hidden action, there's warfare, there's all kinds of different stuff going on in StarCraft 2. It's a much more complicated game in some ways. But yeah, they seem to be making crazy progress. And then they'll teach it Grand Theft Auto. It'll steal all our cars. And then it'll be Gears of War, and then that's it. Then we're all dead.
But there's still nothing, I'm told, that can fold laundry.
Yeah, there's amazing. There is some amazing footage. There is a laundry folding robot.
No.
But you look at it, and it just looks incredibly slow and clumsy. And then you're told this footage is speeded up 50 times.
So we'll be folding laundry for robots, at least.
Yeah, that seems to be the way forward.
Does it worry you at all, having looked through all of these stories going back, you know, through the history of time and these inventions, that stuff like AlphaGo Zero or whatever it's calling itself nowadays, where that element of the technology and the technologist often doesn't think that much about the impact of, they're more interested in developing the technology and what they can get the technology to do than they are sort of the impact of certain things on society, on life, on the environment. They're not that concerned about whether people lose their jobs. They just want to build the most amazing piece of artificial intelligence. But then that combines with the thing that really makes successful is when someone works out a way to make a profit from it and turn it into a business. So logically, as human beings, what we'd do is we'd all get ourselves an AlphaGo Zero, and we'd basically just program that to do our job for us for the rest of our lives, and I'd go off snowboarding and the robot would do my job. But that's not what will happen. Business will get its hands on the robots, and we'll all end up working twice as hard, perhaps in our new laundry folding jobs, whilst the sort of technologists and the business world takes advantage of us.
Yeah, it does worry me because the history of technology is full of unintended consequences, and many of the unintended consequences are good, but not all of them. I think in the long run, we may have to just rethink the way that our economy works in the following sense. We have always, at least in the recent history of capitalism, the last 200 years at least, we've said, look, everyone has an economic value and they can use that economic value by selling their labour in a labour market, and that will buy food, that will buy shelter, medicine, whatever they need. And yeah, we've got the welfare state around the edges of that, but fundamentally, to buy the stuff you need, you use your economic value, you sell your labour. It's quite possible. We're not there yet at all, but it might happen very suddenly. Who knows? It's quite possible in the future there'll be a lot of people who have no economic value. And there's nothing that they can do that a computer can't do better. Now, what do we do with that? Historically, it's just like, well, you've got no economic value, so tough. But there's no way if 20, 30, 50, 90% of people are in that position. It would be crazy not to completely rethink the way the welfare state works. And the most obvious innovation there is this thing that people get excited about, which is universal basic income. I think it's probably a little early to have a universal basic income, but down the track you could see it. And that's a situation where you just go, yeah, somebody's got all the robots. The robots are doing all the work. The government taxes that, and we all get the fruits of that, and we all get to go snowboarding or whatever. And that's fine. I don't really see why that can't happen, but it is clearly a huge change from the way society is currently organised. And I emphasise, we are not there yet, but you could certainly imagine it happening.
Special guest Tim Harford, editor Simon Lambert, personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss, and you can buy, of course, Tim's latest book and all his others, but 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy in all good bookstores, and download his podcast from iTunes. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast and Tim's, of course, why not rate us all on iTunes and tell your friends and family.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. Giving you 100% security for your savings, backed by HM Treasury.